reach the Outrider Podcast. Hello, and welcome to episode 29 of the Outrider Podcast. I, of course, am Jason Quinn Millott, your host-ish thing, person, guy. Anyway, today's guest is Lynn Sloan. Lynn is a debut author. Her first novel, Principles of Navigation, is out from Fomite Press. And if you are so inclined, and I highly recommend that you do become so inclined, go out and grab a copy of this book. You'll need to order it online from Fomite Press directly. Your bookstore might be able to order it for you as a special order. You can read more about Fomite Press at its website, which is, give me a second here, fomitepress.com. And find out how they work. They're a bit of an alternative press run by a guy named Mark Estrin. Maybe you've heard of him, maybe you haven't. That's okay if you haven't. It's not a big snooty deal if you haven't. I'm not trying to be snooty. That's one of the things I have been purposefully trying to avoid it, even though it kind of occurs naturally. I don't know that that's a thing that really should be admitted, but oh well. As you all know, maybe not all of you, but those who occasionally read the literary web out there, there's been a bit of a throwdown lately about this guy named Ryan Boudinot. I don't know. He's got three novels out. He wrote a piece for The Stranger, talking about these things that he was never able to say when he was teaching at an MFA program. And there's been a lot of blowback on that, an argument and debate about some of his points, because he was being curmudgeonly, and in at least one instance and a few other instances was really kind of a dick. But it's created a lot of talk in the MFA world, which is kind of added to, I think, some of the at least in my thinking, some of the debate about the usefulness or unusefulness of the MFA. And as someone who grew up out in Western Kansas, where I didn't know any writers at all and didn't think that there that writers were anywhere around me, and it turned out that, you know, I just had to go to college to find them. You know, there is a certain I've always been very proud and very grateful for my MFA experience, because it gave me a chance to encounter lots of other writers, to take this two-year, very concentrated focus and just be able to talk and write and be around bookish literary writer people that I'd normally not ever around in Kansas. 'Cause everybody's here, you know, is farming, agging, and, you know, worshiping Ayn Rand or something. Anyway, that went a little off. But let's, you know, I have the monthly writer salon. The people that write come by my apartment once a month. We hang out. We drink a lot of wine, a lot of wine. But, you know, Boudinot's article, or however he says his last name, really kind of sparked this thing. And I've been thinking a lot about it. I wrote a bit about it on my blog. But I guess what I wanted to say here is that the thing that I liked about the piece was something that I feel is not being done enough with young writers, which is coming right out and being brutally damn honest with them. This is hard, being a writer. It takes a lot of determination. You have to face a lot of discouragement. And if a cranky, curmudgeonly, bitter, you know, nasty writing instructor can say the things that Ryan did in his piece on The Stranger, and that discourages someone from being a writer, then that person probably shouldn't have been a writer. And we need to quit hand-holding and coddling these people. He might have thought he only had, you know, two or three real-deal students in his classes, but I bet you over the years we're going to find out that there were a lot more than that. Kids that maybe at that time when his classes didn't quite display the fervent talent that he was looking for, but had a certain level of determination that he didn't suss out. That's, I think, what carried me through, at least to the first book. We're going to see how long that determination stands up when I'm struggling to get the second one out. Maybe I should have been a plumber. Anyway, let's get on to my conversation with Lynn Sloan. As you'll hear from the conversation with Lynn, she had a very long route to becoming a writer in later in life, and that experience, that wisdom, shines through in her book and in this conversation, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did having it. Lynn is fabulous, so let's listen to her.
Hello, Jason.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I'm good. Are we videoing?
We don't have to. I just put it on because I hardly ever get to use it. Most of the time, people just want to do the phone thing, but all I ever record is audio, but...
It's nice to see you, even if you don't see me right now.
That's okay. Well, I hit the record button, so we just jump right in. So I thought what I'd do is I'd start with your book.
Okay.
Which is a bit different from my normal format. And part of the reason is because I have a confession to make.
All right.
When Caitlin first sent your book to me with the cover letter and presenting it to me, I thought, this seems really domestic. And then I thought, well, that's kind of sexist and terrible. And Caitlin wouldn't send me a book she didn't think I would like. I've known Caitlin since my book came out in 2009. She was the publicist for Unbridled Books then. I think she might still be.
I don't think so.
And, you know, so we've known each other a while, and I trust her judgment. So I started reading, and I thought, domestic's unfair. Because, you know, for a guy who's never been married and doesn't have kids, there's always this little fear in the back of our head that, oh, it's another book about babies. But it's not, really. And what I loved most about it is it gets the whole initial, you know, I guess we're not going to give any spoilers away with this. It gets the initial miscarriage out of the way real quick and jumps right into something that's I found very interesting and gripping was that split that type of thing can cause between people and how it rejiggers their intentions and desires and their direction through life, which, you know, glances off the title of the book. I thought it was wonderful. I loved your book very, very much.
And you were surprised to love it. Well, thank you.
Well, I was more surprised at my kind of knee-jerk dude reaction, which is something else I kind of wanted to... Are you worried about that kind of... how it will be accepted in the world? Do you ever think about that kind of... why it is that guys have that sort of reaction to women writers and books that appear to have a quote-unquote domestic bent to them?
Well, of course I am. And I've always wondered about that because most of us live in domestic situations, even if we're single.
Right.
And very few of us live in offices or institutions. So
exactly.
Domestic life is pretty close to all of us. And I wish I had thought a little more carefully at the beginning of this about this ghettoization that was possible with my novel. Mm-hmm. Because I think maybe I would have picked something more like an intergalactic or some adventure on the Orinoco River. But I started with a puzzle. And, you know, I wanted to write a novel, and I was looking for a subject for a novel. Many people start novels and they have a kind of burning story they wish to tell.
Right.
Sometimes it's related to their own experience or something in their family, but something that has snagged a fishhook in their heart for a while, and they want to write about that. And I was larking along, writing short stories and having a good time, and thought, oh, I want to take on the bigger form.
Right.
So it's quite a practical or an impractical, but it was a kind of calculated thought. And I was looking around for a topic, and I saw two people in an art exhibition that just could not have been more dissimilar. The husband was this really cool, charismatic man, and the wife was so modest and self-effacing. And I thought, and they were both young. I mean, they were under 30. And I thought, well, people can grow apart in a marriage, but usually when it's a new marriage, they look like they are from the same culture. I mean, generally, our relationships that we form in our life are, at the beginning, when we're young people, I think they're very much like us, people who sort of shore up our identity, and they like the same music, they go to the same movies, they read the same books. They're right. not. They might look a little different from us, but we share our same culture.
Oh, there's a narcissism to it, kind of.
Well, maybe it's comfort. Maybe, you know, in a wild and crazy world, we need our posse with us. Mm-hmm. Now, as time goes on, that changes. Work throws us into relationship with people quite unlike us, and we may find, oh, I like this person. We connect, even though nothing is on the surface. We don't look alike. But in a young marriage, I was surprised to see people, a couple, a man and a woman, who look so separate and so different. And there used to be a column in a magazine my mother read when I was a girl, and it was, "Can this marriage be saved?" And that I'm here was in a Luke's art opening, and that question popped into my head about this couple, and I doubted it could be saved. So I thought, well, what brought them together, and what might drive them apart? So that's where this started, really, with not enough thought in the beginning. And then as I went on, I found so many ideas or things collected around that theme of what draws us together, what separates us, marriages and other kinds of sort of institutionalized relationships are called, you know, it's called a marriage. It's a thing. It's a sharply defined institution, even right. if it's quite different from one to another. But any marriage has two different individuals who will always be individuals. And even no matter how intimate and well-connected they might be, they are still separate. And in my novel, that separateness and their separate needs and at root identities are brought forward as hardship strikes them. So I didn't, some people say a domestic novel is sort of like, you know, a chamber quartet, and you know, the
right.
big novels, you know, those are symphonies or operas. Well, I like chamber music. I like small music as well right. as big music.
Right. And I think that this, there are places for both novels, and I think the publishing industries need to find a niche, which I think is interesting about Fomite in particular, your publisher, and mine, like Unbridled, and the yes. kinds of things that Caitlin has been kind of raising flags for me about, is that there's this approach that there's no difference between these the small microcosmic supposedly domestic novel and the larger epic novel, and that what's interesting is that men and women write both. There are men who write the small, you know, domestic book, and women that write the big giant epic. And the big publishers, they like having the little pigeonhole. They can say, this book will appeal to women, and that's all it can appeal to. And I'm always disheartened by that, because some of my favorite writers are women. Bobby Louise Hawkins, who taught at Naropa University. My roommate from graduate school, Laura Holly, who is a brilliant, brilliant writer, even though she's not writing right now. And I want to go back to Colorado and kick her in the pants. And I think we shortchange writers, particularly women writers, by not presenting their books in a way that can appeal to the other half of the reading audience. And We cripple male writers that don't like to write the big so-called masculine epic books.
Right. Yes, that's right.
And so I was.
Both of these ghettoizations work in nobody's favor. I mean,
Right. Except maybe the publishers.
well, except maybe. I think that to have books that fit into niches with defined audiences is probably a simple way of going about marketing. Mm-hmm. But for both writers and readers, it's fun to read across the spectrum.
Absolutely.
When I was, one time I was in an elevator with a friend of mine, a very good writer, and not a, a book writer, but an art critic. Mm-hmm. And she was telling me all the books she was recommending to me. And I said, they all have women writers. And she said, those are the voices I like.
Right.
And I started to puzzle about that and think, are there voices we like? Do we tend to like our own gender better? That's not true for me, mm-hmm. but perhaps for some other readers, it is true. But again, what a loss. And what fun it is to find out sometimes that a writer that you thought was one, you know, was a man, was a woman, and,
right.
and vice versa. It's just, it upends the kind of blinkers you might have on yourself.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's, I think, part of the reason why I read is not to find something like myself. The writers that I've come to really value the most since leaving my 20s have been foreign writers or writers that have been, who are immigrants to various countries. Michael Ondaatje is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
And women, because they're coming from a different point of view, a different perspective than what I grew up with, which was, you know, a lot of old white guys. Which gets, which
white guys are really good, you know. Tobias Wolff, you can't beat those. Cheever Updike, you go back a little ways. How can you beat them? They're wonderful writers.
Oh, absolutely.
They're not alone on the top on the top of the mountain, though. They're it's a chorus up there.
Yep. Now, you didn't start off being a writer, correct?
That's
I mean,
right.
I don't do a whole lot of research because it kind of defeats the purpose of the way these I want this podcast to go, because it's all about discovery. And if I go and research you, then I've discovered you before you've told me about you. so I've your author bio is about the most research I've done.
But you read it. No, I'm just
But you started off as a photographer, correct?
That's right, I did. But as a college student, I couldn't settle. I had mm-hmm. basically I had one declared major, but I had equal credits in film studies, art history, and English literature. And
oh,
that
wow.
inability to settle on one thing pretty much defined my whole life. I like a lot of different things.
Uh-huh.
But I went to graduate school and studied fine art photography and taught it and exhibited. And I loved it, and I still love it. I don't want to do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But that. Studying the visual arts really trains you to look at the world very deeply and quickly.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a training I would not want to have missed. But what I felt about my own work in photography was that I wanted to be able to go underneath the top of things. I wanted to mm-hmm. dig under the surface. And in a photograph, I could look at my own work and look at other people's work and associate meanings and interpret things and sort of put things in, but one could never be sure. And even in my own work, I would think that there were things in there and they would escape the notice of others.
Right.
And I became frustrated by the inability to sort of make sure that what I thought was important was getting through.
Right,
and,
right.
and I think that's what took me to write. And I also just became interested in the craft of story writing. I've always loved reading. And mm-hmm. So that's why I came to the end of photography and why I began with fiction.
So growing up, where did you grow up at?
All over. My father was in the Air Force.
That's right. So that's right.
We traveled a lot. And again, I think that was a pleasure mm-hmm. because you would come into a new community and a new school, and you know how tough it is when you're a kid and you come to a new school, you've got your socks are wrong or your hair is wrong.
Right.
You want to quickly fit in. And so you become very fast at assessing what this new culture is like and how to fit in. And that was very handy for me. But I've been from Illinois since college days.
Oh, wow. In Evanston, right?
That's right.
Any time in Chicago? A lot of time?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I've worked in the city and taught in the city, worked, lived. I loved living in the city, but when I had two children, it was easier to come to a district that had decent public school.
Mm-hmm. And my mom's side of the family is from Oak Park. The Hitzman clan, they actually have a funeral home in the Chicago area still, run by family.
Oh, now that's got source of a wonderful setting for a story.
Oh, yeah. My step-great-grandmother lived to be about 98, 99 years old.
Wow.
It's unfortunate I don't have her genes. I always wanted, I got to meet her once in Chicago. And unfortunately for, I did remember writing her a letter after meeting her, and I had some questions about the funeral home, particularly its operation during the Roaring Twenties in Chicago, which I was just wanted to know about so desperately, but I never heard back from her.
Oh, that's a tragedy.
It is.
Information lost.
I'm sure some of my my great uncles, whatever, might have some stories for me if I got in touch with them. But
well, a friend of mine in the city has a brick house with a big brick garage separate from the house in the back off the alley. But it's a 4-car garage. The garage is bigger than the house. And not only is it on the alley, but it has a car entry overhead doors on both sides of the garage so that it's a drive-through door on the alley. And I asked her, I've never seen anything like this. She said, the house is a speakeasy and they took deliveries in the garage.
Nice.
It was so they could get in and out real fast.
That's the kind of stuff I love about old cities like that.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So yeah, where was I going with that? Oh, the Oak Park connection. I always felt a certain kinship to Hemingway because of that. You know, he was from Oak Park. So I think that was kind of why I had developed my first obsession with Hemingway in particular. After high school, where they tried to kill Hemingway for me.
Oh, yeah.
But that's a whole other story.
It is a whole other story. And Oak Park is also very famous for being the home of Frank Lloyd Wright. And mm-hmm. their, you know, guided tours around Oak Park to take you to Hemingway's house and Frank Lloyd Wright's house. I'm waiting for a really famous woman, artist or photographer to make her mark on Oak Park.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of a tiny little town north of Chicago called Lena?
No, I have not.
Okay, that's where my grandfather was a Lutheran minister, and that's where he ended up after finishing seminary or whatever, north of the family home up there in Lena, Illinois. It's a little tiny, tiny town.
You say Lutheran, it sounds like it could be one of the tininess is making me think of an even smaller, perhaps a covenant sect, Swedenborg or something like that. But no, St. Lutheran, mainstream America.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the Illinois is the center of the flyover zone, and mm-hmm. West in general is flyover. It's seen as being a part of the country that is less interesting than the coasts.
I've never understood that. With Chicago up there, I've never understood why anybody would think that would be less interesting.
Well, exactly, because it is. Chicago is so full of interesting stories. A friend of mine just published a book called Corrupt Illinois, and it's the first in a multi-set series, no doubt, but it's detailing all of the shenanigans and the corruption. And how many, at one time, Illinois had, not so long ago, had two sitting governors in the pokey. I mean, I think it's right now, actually.
Yeah.
We have two governors in the federal prison. So with a level of corruption that this state has. But apart from that, Illinois is just a complicated state. And mm-hmm. actually, all of the Midwest, I mean, these are, what's so nice is they have big stretches that you can define yourself. That is, that individuals can make them right. who they wish to be. And in the city of Chicago, there are organic farms along former railway lines mm-hmm. that are run by people on welfare. Uh-huh. And growing fresh produce for the community. And in high rises, there are earth boxes where they're growing herbs on the top of high rises. Organic earth boxes are something that were designed for African places where the soil is depleted. There are 1 cubic meter of good soil. So you could find a landscape on top of a high rise. You could mm-hmm. find a garden in below a railway tracks. And that's just in the city. And then you go out and it just keeps going. The surprising and interesting things.
So mostly around from the Illinois area, let's see, let me look at your bio. So Northwestern University was the undergrad, correct?
That's right.
Now, were you taking like creative writing courses as an undergrad and then as a grad student, or was that just something you were doing on the side, kind of as a hobby, or...
I never taken a creative writing class. For one reason or another, I never even took a comp class. and it was only recently that I found out what a gerund was. I'm not joking. Somehow because of traveling around a lot in my youth, and then by the time I sort of settled, I was, you know, okay enough with language that mm-hmm. I kept testing out of those classes. So... I truly never had a writing class, even the most basic composition class. So I've had the struggle to figure this out. Where do the commas go? And maybe that's being. So I did study writing, but after I published a couple of short stories, I found out about a writer's group in my community, and I joined up with them. And the proposition was that we would study one writer's work for mm-hmm. a year at a time and really dig in. And that's how I learned to write.
Wow. So who are some of your writers? Who are the touchstones, the inspirations, the ones you go back to when you're feeling kind of lost and need some inspiration?
Well, I'm going to answer this sort of two ways. The writers I studied when I was in this group was everyone from Francine Prose and Charles Baxter, Rosellen Brown. E. Young Lee is coming to this group this year. I've been invited as a guest. I'm not in the group anymore. So it's a very good, really fine writers that the group studies. And when I need inspiration, it's interesting. I sometimes don't go to the writers I read. Like, mm-hmm. Right now I'm reading Juno Diaz, and the last book I read was Marilynne Robinson before that. And I read Kibata's On Fresh Snow on Fuji. I mean, Edward Jones, I'm late to the game. I read that a couple of weeks ago. So those are the writers that I enjoy reading. But when I'm sort of stuck as a writer, I love going to craft books.
Oh, really?
I love it. I mean, Francine Prose is Reading Like a Writer. I mean, that is such a fun book to read. And books like that just get me going again. Like, oh, why was I stuck? Look how good this is. And that's what inspires me. So I'm sort of a bifurcated reader. I read craft books or craft essays. There's a wonderful article on copy editing in the current New Yorker. It's the anniversary issue, and a woman named Norris, who is a copywriter there. And it's just such a stirring book on copy editing, or essay on copy editing. And then when I want to read, I just dig right in. Right now, I've got my pages open to Jenny Oldfield's Department of Speculation. So I read two different kinds of books.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've kind of drifted away from the books on craft because my time is so bizarrely, you know, fractured these days between the day job and trying to write and reading for the podcast and trying to do my own reading. And then also trying to find that downtime where the brain can just disconnect from analysis and processing and thought and just drift. That big pause kind of explains it all right there.
Big pause Wonderful.
You know, it's just burnt and brain fart, and all I want to do is sit there and stare at the wall sometime. And the idea of picking up another craft book after is just kind of feels like, oh, that's going back to school again.
Well, maybe, if I had studied it as you have, I would feel that way. But for me, these are just adventures in new angles to think about writing. They're prods to me. And you speak about needing empty time to just and to think. Yesterday, someone got emailed me and was kind of peeved. It was an editor and was kind of peeved because couldn't find me on Twitter. And I wrote back to her that I took my guide from Russell Brand, the British comic, who said, "Of course I'm not on Twitter. I'm a serious person." if Russell Brand saying that, I can too. Among the reasons I don't want to be on Twitter is I think we all, well, speak for me, I take in too much data as it is anyway. Yeah. I want to have less. And I think it's really important to just shut down and stare at the wall at times and just not continually take in more data from outside.
Yeah. If you can't process it unless you stop at some point and just let it happen.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So that kind of brings up something else. I mean, one of the things that there's a lot of hand-wringing about this at times, I think, among the literati class is the value or lack of value of the MFA program. And not having been in an MFA program, but you've been in an academic setting where you had, in a way, kind of access to writers if you wanted to talk to them, correct?
That's right.
Who are some of the, because you've taught at universities, you've done this thing, who are some of the your writer friends that you've encountered over the years that have been helpful in one way or another?
Well, first, I have an MFA, but it's in the visual arts.
Right.
So that kind of sharp training and by sharp training, I do mean critical training of ability to parse arguments, to discuss at a kind of intense level, and to dance out on the end of a limb on an argument just for the hell of it. that's MFA training that carries across both fields. What's wonderful about Chicago is that there are MFA-trained writers, and they just mix it up with us peons who are not MFA trained. At one time I was, I forget, was I an associate or an assistant fiction editor? I was one of those for the journal called Story Quarterly that was at that time published here. And it's now out of Rutgers, I think. But in any case, back in the day, it was here in this community. And us readers and people would get together talking about things, there was really no difference between it. You didn't pay attention to who had the MFAs. After you've been thinking about literature for a while and trying to write well yourself,
right?
The questions are the same. You don't need the union club, the union card to get into the discussion.
Right.
You simply have to care about the same things and enjoy the same things and be pleased, be interested in who won the Nobel Prize in Literature and to argue whether it was a good decision or a bad.
Right.
To have read what's coming out, to have arguments about things that other people would wonder, what is a small field? So I think this is a town, perhaps like others, where there's a great deal of generosity and it's not as segregated, I think.
Right.
The in with the in crowd is not as, I don't see that here.
I've always, coming from where I do, I grew up out in Western Kansas, and the first time I ever met a living, breathing published writer was when I got to college. And so there was in Kansas, there's a definitive lack of writers. And at least when I was growing up, it was a total desert of people that were interested in actually talking about literature. And so the for me, what I always say when the MFA argument comes up about, particularly about writing, because one side always wants to say, well, you can't teach talent, you can't teach storytelling. And for me, it's like, no, you're probably right about that. But this was the MFA was an opportunity for me to hang around with people that had that same focused, intense interest in one particular thing. And that opportunity was invaluable to talk to other young writers. And then, of course, with I went to Naropa University. Mm-hmm. So their summer writing program brought in, you know, 20, 30 writers a week for 4 weeks that I just got to soak up information from. And it was a crash course. It improved my breadth of reading, my interest, everything that I could not have gotten on my own as quickly in Wichita, Kansas.
When I was in graduate school, my day job was a picture editor at Time Incorporated. And
wow.
It was a fabulous job. It was a production job. I did not pick pictures. I oversaw their translation into the magazine. And that meant making sure that they were cropped properly, that they had been retouched if necessary, that the plate translation, and captions lined up. Anyway, mm-hmm. It was a technical job. And one of the biggest magazines in the world, the decisions made at where I was went out to printing plants in Sydney and Hong Kong and all over the globe. So it was a large publication. And then I remember one night it was a great job. It paid a lot of money. And I started at 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon and would, until the magazine went to bed, we worked. And if the Pope died that night, we'd be working until late afternoon on Sunday. And if nobody important died that night, war didn't break out, I was usually through about 5 or 6 in the morning on Sunday morning. But we would, in the middle of the night, we would go out to a nice cafe across the place called the Soul Queen Diner. And
the Soul Queen Diner?
Yes, is that fine? And
it is.
And we would be talking about other things. And one time, a journalist from another publication came and joined our table. And he was with a magazine called Hoofbeats Magazine. And I thought that was just hysterically funny that here were people from Time Magazine and then Hoofbeats. And it was my first understanding that there was something called narrowcast publications. Hoofbeats, by the way, was a special publication for trotting horses, not for all kinds of horses, but just hoofbeats of trotters.
Right.
And that made me realize that there was a wide world that I was unacquainted with. This was only one aspect of it. But this man at Hoofbeats was just as intensely interested in his work, and the questions and the issues in the publication that he was working on, and training issues, and where horses were coming from, and what were the safety issues. And he was just as intense as anybody at my table was. And that introduced me to the idea that it is a rich and complicated world, and you can live in Kansas and think you've not read a writer, and yet mm-hmm. The ghost of Willa Cather, right? She's there somewhere. And I grew up in a home. I was just sure my parents were just rubes of the worst order, and they were anti-intellectual, and I was how did I end up here? The stork brought me to the wrong house. And then I remember my father reading Mishima and Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald, and he would read me passages from that. And my mother was reading Eudora Welty, and I thought they were rubes. It was only when I was a little older, I went to college, and I realized that these people that they were reading were actually, well, of course I knew these names, but when I saw some of the smaller volumes on the shelves, I started to realize I thought I grew up in an intellectual desert, and I hadn't. And it was just my own small-mindedness not to recognize this elsewhere. But for most of the world, what you and I care about, Jason, writing and literature and how it broadens what we know mm-hmm. about the world, the reason you like to read immigrant literature, the reason that I enjoy places from other cultures too, is because it opens up our lives.
Right.
Well, I guess other people have other ways of opening up their lives, and maybe even some of them are closet readers too.
I hope so.
I hope so. For the book industry.
Yeah. I wanted to ask some questions about working for Time. So you were cropping and making sure everything fit on the page with the pictures.
It was a totally technical job. It would now be done on a computer. At that time, well, it was done on a crude computer. But right now, this could be done anywhere. But at this time, it was tied to the central production plant, which was here in Chicago. It moved to Connecticut after that, and then it disappeared as a production place.
Were there any photographs that you worked on at that time that really just kind of jumped out and grabbed your attention and have stuck with you?
What struck with me is that there was always a picture with a bare-breasted woman in every damned issue of the book. And it didn't take, you know, you're looking at separate pages or two-page spreads. And so after this came to my attention, I had to sort of find it, you know, because sometimes I'd be working on something that, and the bare-breasted woman, usually, of course, it was someone from another country, but not always. It was sort of a hunt where are the tits in this issue, and there was always one. So that's the thing that I most remind and remember of the high-minded photographic issues. Of Time Inc. Now, in graduate school, when I really loved documentary photography, and I became really enamored of documentary photography. And but I will say that the people who were published in Time at that time were, even if they were good photographers, their pictures were flattened out, trimmed for content, the barest of contents only, and mostly they were not interesting. That's changed again. All publications are in such tumult with their web presences and everything. But back then it was just, where are the boobs in this issue?
Wow. So did you have time? Did you ever consider doing documentary photography or journalism type of stuff, or just doing fine art?
Well, after I got out of graduate school, I realized I had to make a living, and it should have struck me a little sooner than that. But in any case, it didn't. And and so actually, that's how I made my living for a few years. If you don't work for a publication, it's called editorial photography, and that is to say, journalism is obviously for journals and mags. And so editorial is when you work for an institution that needs to have material documented. So I worked for Native American health clinics in, I don't remember now, I think Iowa. I worked on a train book for Scholastic. I worked on a number of social, with what are not-for-profits in the city of Chicago, documenting things that they wanted done. And of course, it was a lot of fun. And in my own work, I went into more sort of not documentary work for a long time, and that was to say pictures that were more meditative or beautiful. And then sort of towards, as I came to wanting to do documentary work, and I did two big documentary projects. One was in the late 80s. I did a project with people with HIV illnesses. And AIDS, and that was the first time I started to deploy text with my pictures, because I wanted my pictures to be, for me not to shine as an image maker, for these to look naturalistic, to look, the photographs were intended to look like you were meeting this person, that you were not, the person was not interpreted by the photographer. I had recessive tech, you know, I tried not to be visible. And then I included, when these pictures were exhibited and published, conversations that I had with them. And they were very brief, because I'm very aware of the differences between how we look at a picture and how we read, and the differences in time and how the brain works. So these, the textual pieces that went with the photographs were quite brief. Sometimes they would be quotes. Sometimes they'd be a piece of a conversation between me and them, or between them and their daughter, or them and their father, what have you. And, so that was a big documentary project. I did that for about 3 years, and that was at a time when the it was an extremely socially imperiled disease. To get that, any of those illnesses was to really, people were talking about quarantines and right. There's a great deal of horror. And then another documentary project I did was when the big mining companies in Minnesota started to just pulled out. The mines weren't worked out, but they just, it was no longer profitable. It was far more profitable work on the coast. And so these communities, which had been very ethnically diverse, and miners had come over several generations from all kinds of places, but many of them in Eastern Europe. And all of a sudden, their economic base was just in a season gone. And it was like everybody was laid off within a year. And to go up, so I did, that's called the Iron Range, and I did a series of photographs up there of the teenagers and the old folks in the nursing home and the people at church and the miners and the librarians and the people in the cafe. And so these are photographs, again, with text, with them talking about the circumstances of their lives. Wow. Fun work.
Have you found that... That experience and that focus for all those years on photography has, in a way, impacted your writing? Do you feel that it's given a visual element to your writing over the years? Has increased the way you put things on the page imagistically?
I have to fight it because I could just describe the wallpaper for pages. You know, I love description, but one of the things I'm heartened by is that when people don't know that I'm a photographer, that they don't read my, they don't talk about how imagistic my writing is. And I'm glad of that, because people who know that I began as a photographer, they almost always talk about, oh, you're just so image-based. And so I'm really glad when people don't know that, they don't see that. It's something I try to fight. But it's, of course, it's how I take in the world is through images. And but other people are not as interested in the descriptions of the wallpaper and the light on the desk as I am. I mean, I can't go on for hours.
That's something that was always lacking in my writing early on, was that the vivid image, particularly before I ended up in graduate school. And I think a lot of it was, I didn't know how to knit what I was doing as a poet and what I liked about movies and television and photography, which was what I discovered in high school, into the course of constructing a narrative. And it was actually Michael Ondaatje that kind of unlocked that door and threw me out the out into the yard with that one. And it was because he was obsessed with filmmaking. And it has incorporated a lot of that visual element, and also the editorial, the constructive aspects of film, jump cuts and flashbacks and all this other stuff. So I have to really work at taking that little bit of a visual element and tiny, tiny bit of a experimentation and bringing that into fiction, as opposed to fighting it the way that you did. It's fascinating.
You know, Laura Mulvey wrote a wonderful essay in the 70s, and I'm blanking on the name of the essay, but it was about narrative cinema. And she's talking, she uses as her example mostly films of the 50s and the 40s, but in any case, she's talking about the difference between narrative and spectacle. And she, in her view, spectacle is when everything slows down, where the story is no longer being told, where it is just stopped, action, not that the action actually stops, but that you're no longer in the story, but you're held in a kind of moment. And so she takes a number of films and analyzes them in terms of what propels the narrative and what stops the narrative. Almost all films have a mix of spectacle and narrative. And so I think what you're talking about is finding the right spectacle and finding the moment where you hold on to it, and that it is a resonant enough image that it's worth holding on to, and that and it resonates. You know, it has all those associations that you want for yourself and for the reader.
Exactly. Yeah. Amazing. So you'd been publishing short stories. When was the first short story published?
Around 1990.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So do you have enough for a collection? Have you got a collection out there? Is that the next step?
I'm not sure it is. I do. I think that, again, this is probably the difference between an MFA trained person and someone who's just bumbled into the party, is that many people I know who have MFAs also have story collections. They've seen it that way. The part of training is not just because the courses run long enough to get stories written, and it's harder to write a novel in the graduate school.
Right.
But also that you're thinking right from the beginning of what are the interconnections between what I'm writing. My stories were always pretty haphazardly chosen. And so I've thought about, I have a working title for a collection, and I have some stories of maybe 13 that would fit. And I'll tell you now, spoiler alert, the title would be Telling Tales. And that's because the stories all involve, the short stories within would all involve action that is displaced by tales that are told within, lies or true stories that shape the action. So I sort of have that cooking. But in truth, my principal next move will be working on another novel. I have a first draft of a novel that I want to go back and redo. But I've got an arch from a beginning and a middle and an end. But I want to. It's not the story I want to write now. It's nice to be able to write something, put it away, and then realize, oh no, I've got to do that again. the interval allows you to really re-see it, which is hard. It's all a fast and steady process. It's nice to have a gap.
Now, how did you find out about Fomite Press and Mark Estrin?
You know, I didn't know about Mark Estrin until I knew about Fomite. I had was trying sending my novel out to agents, and I quickly became disheartened because they would often say, this is beautifully written, but I don't think I can sell this book. It doesn't take long before your sort of heart gets broken. And well, not broken, but you think, okay, is there a better way than reading these letters? And so I started to look around at independent presses, and a friend of mine said she had submitted something to Fomite and they had rejected her in the most humane way she had ever been. And she said, this guy is amazingly smart and kind, and at least you'll get a decent rejection from them. Right. And so, hoping for nothing more than that, actually hoping for everything, I submitted my novel, and he said yes. So I feel very lucky. There's not finding these independent presses is really kind of a scavenger hunt. You look
sometimes
at books that your friends are looking at. You can go on the web and you can find some, but some come up, and some of them look like they're reasonable, but you realize it's a press that's only producing their own friends' books,
right?
Or their own books. And so it's that's okay. It's an adventure.
Cool.
Yeah. Then I found out Mark Estrin is really a nifty man with a wonderful experience as both a writer and a musician and an actor and a theater person, the founder of a very exciting theater group called Bread and Puppets. Nifty man.
I haven't had the chance to meet him yet, but he's a fellow unbridled author.
That's right.
And my editor, Fred Ramey, pretty much every time we sit down and talk about books, he tells me that he thinks Mark's book, Insect Dreams, is one of the greatest novels of the last century. And, and I've been kind of afraid of it, but still wanting to read it, so I don't know where to go. And I think that's also why I would like to talk to Mark, but, having him praised to me so frequently by Fred kind of has me intimidated.
Well, last week, a young woman from Champlain College in Burlington, Vermont, called me up to interview me because she was doing a piece on Mark. And I asked her how she decided to choose him as a subject for this Journalism 101 class. And she said she had been to a community event and she heard him. And then she went and talked to him. And he was such a nice person.
Yeah.
So I say that by saying I don't think he would be at all intimidating.
I hope. Yeah, that's That is true. But I don't know, I still have these little residual insecurities from childhood.
Yeah, sure.
Had I'll put this in air quotes, friend, who used to tell me that I would never be as smart as he was. And I think I was just gullible enough to believe him. Until I grew up and went to college and realized, no, I'm actually kind of good at this thinking thing.
Don't just dislike it when somebody sort of poaches, claims a piece of the land that you think you have a right to, but because they say they got there first, you kind of almost believe them.
Yeah.
What is it? That's what being a child is about. You let that happen to you.
So with Fomite, I was very curious because I went and I looked at his site, and they do the books in a kind of print on demand thing. What has Mark told you about that, and what's their approach? Because I'm very curious. And
well, that's interesting. A friend of mine is with another small press, and that's not print on demand. And they do beautiful books too. I'm not going to name this press, but they do beautiful books. But they have to print a print run of several thousand,
right,
and then they stack up in their basement. And you hope for no floods. And the model that Mark is with print on demand is that you print them as you need them, and it's a far better business model. I think Mark's very careful about economics, and by that he wants a wise business model, something that allows him to keep going and publishing other books that he likes.
Right.
And if he invests in a bunch of books that are in the basement or the garage, that can hamstring him. But that said, if you've seen my book, and I don't know if you have an advanced reader copy or you've... Okay. But they're very beautifully done. And I don't, they're just the print quality, the paper quality. These are gorgeous books. Mm-hmm. So some print on demand are print on demand can be as beautiful as any other kind of book, or it can be less beautifully done.
It looks like just bound typewritten pages. Yeah. That's the thing because I used to work for an independent bookstore, and we would have authors that would come in and ask about our consignment program because they'd either self-published or had gone with some weird regional press that did not seem to have a stable handle on distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would be like short discounted books that our inventory manager wouldn't order in because bookstores survive on a 40% margin. And if you only right. get a book at a 10% discount, you're not making enough money to keep the lights on.
That's right.
And I'm surprised at the number of people that would come in with their books to put on consignment didn't understand that about bookstores and the publishing industry. And then they would hand me these books, and I would think to myself, I would not pay what you're asking for this.
Yes. Yes.
And by the way, I love the cover on this. That photograph is beautiful.
Isn't that beautiful? That's done by a former graduate student of mine.
Oh, nice.
And that was a picture from her MFA project. She also is a faculty member now, she did that picture maybe 8 or 9 years ago. But it's funny, Mark selected that. Mark gave me a great deal of freedom. And he said, if you want to have a hand in designing the cover, fine. Now, they do beautiful covers. You looked over their site, so you know that Fomite produces lovely books. And so all you have to say to me is you get a hand in the design, and I'll take it. So I introduced Mark to Sarah's graphic design work, her aunt. He said, well, I'm not sure. And then he looked at it, and he said, oh, my gosh, her work's beautiful. And by the way, this one picture I thought would be make a good cover image. And I hesitated because it's a fine art photograph. It's in a lot of good collections. And I didn't want to say, well, would you submit this for the commercial purpose of a cover? But when I mentioned it to Sarah, she said, oh, I would be thrilled to do it. And so she also designed the cover.
Oh, nice. So you're with... That's the thing. What I find so fascinating, there's... Because on one hand, now we have the self-publishing Amazon stuff, and I've often wondered if that could be used in a more productive way than it is with the self-publishing. And then you have the traditional, publishers, even that includes the small presses that are like associated with Publishers Group West that do the big traditional distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this weird environment now where, you know, on one hand, they talk about how literary reading is declining. You get those annual NEA assessments, and fewer and fewer people are reading literary works. And then you turn around and Amazon is reporting, you know, sales are climbing for ebooks and these little genre self-published things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to myself, how, as writers, as people that are interested in this and who are working with publishers that have interesting ideas, like Mark, Fred Ramey and Greg Michelson at Unbridled, and right. and the people at $2 Radio.
Yes, they're great too.
And where am I going with this? It kind of goes, I guess it kind of jumps to my usual question that I like to ask towards the end, and we're almost at the end, is these types of things feel like this kind of organic groundswell of making literature and the literary community in this country a sustainable environment, because mm-hmm. the traditional publishing model that's pushed by the remaining big five publishers is this huge celebrity model. You know, they right. get someone famous with a big marketing platform, they pay them a lot of money, and that's what they use to survive to the next year. And maybe they publish one or two brand new unknown writers.
That's right.
That's not a sustainable environment. That's not going to survive, and it's proven. And then on the other hand, with the self-publishing stuff, you don't have any, there's no quality control, really.
You know, it's like peer-reviewed journals of mm-hmm. you know, in the sciences. Anybody can go out and print a paper and put it up on the internet on some wacko and unfounded theory. But a peer-reviewed journal in the sciences or in medicine or one of these fields means mm-hmm. other experts have looked at it and said, this is worth considering. This has meat. This is properly done. And I think that the issue with the difference between the self-published and something from a press, be it big or small, is that it's been validated by people who know something about the field, have a history with the field, and have standards.
Right.
It doesn't mean that self-published work couldn't meet those standards. Sometimes right. they can, but a lot of it really can't. And we've seen examples of that.
Yeah. Well, it's all about that vetting process. Someone
that's right.
said, I'm willing to invest in this. And that means a little bit of something.
I think it means a lot.
But so I guess we're having your experience with the way Mark's running his press and some of the other small presses you know about, what other things do you think we as writers can start to do beyond, you know, continuing to write good books and getting them out into the world to help that sustainability of a literary culture, social engagement, you know, anything? What do you think we should be doing?
I think a lot of it's going on already, and I think read books, buy books, follow what's going in at small presses, read blogs that are promoting the work of a wide range of writers, the Nervous mm-hmm. Breakdown, what you're doing. Things like this really contribute to a lively community. I also think that it's fun for people to start their own journal, literary journal, not maybe a press, but to start small with a journal. Why not? It doesn't take what it used to take.
Yeah.
And to realize that because you're not with Ferris Strauss does not mean that you're not a really legitimate writer,
right.
and that there is a lively dialogue. And the reason why I think this is springing up, why independent presses are succeeding, and why there is this foment, is because what the big five are doing is not meeting the needs of the reading population.
Exactly.
And so other things are coming up right now. I think it's extremely exciting. An image that I have is of the early days of cable TV, when there were channels in the U.S., you know, PBS, NBC, and those channels, and they had a lock on content.
Right.
And then cable sprang up, and at first, local access was about it, and it was terrible. And high school basketball, terrible. But look what's happened with cable TV.
Right.
Stuff. So I think that the small press industry in the U.S. is kind of like in the first decade or so of cable TV. There's some really exciting things going on right now, and it will be the new form.
That's interesting. No one's ever made that comparison before. I wouldn't have known it. I mean, I was so damn young with the rise of cable TV. I didn't know anything about that, but wow.
Well, you might have been still in the days when it was all, was the local basketball game.
Yeah.
And a few people talking about, you know, the city hall meeting or something. and I think that's still somewhere on the spectrum, but as you know, and I think this happened in Hollywood. I was talking to a film critic recently, and he said, uh-huh, the same thing happened in Hollywood. It used to be all the big studios, and now everything's independently produced, and they find the issue is the distribution now.
Right.
We are in changing industries.
Hmm. Yeah, distribution's that's the bug in the soup, I think, is distribution. Because a lot of the DRM stuff that some writers like Cory Doctorow complain about, and it relates even to the music industry a little bit.
Yes.
Is he has one of his three rules is if someone puts a lock on something you own but doesn't give you the key, that lock's not there for your benefit.
That's right.
And yes, Amazon is just distribution, and they're trying to break the back of the publishing industry. Mm-hmm. Which is disturbing as hell.
Yes, it is.
And, you know, and unfortunately, it would be great if writers were so interesting that we could go out and write in public and people would buy tickets to watch us write, but we're not musicians, you know?
You know, I was at a farmer's market this summer, a wonderful farmer's market, and there was a poet sitting there with an old-fashioned typewriter,
right,
and gave her a word, and she typed you a poem and passed it out. She also, at that time, was selling her own tiny chapbooks.
Right.
And I thought that was, she was the kind of person who, she was having fun. She wouldn't have otherwise. It also brought a lot of people into thinking about poetry that hadn't. And it was a very lively and unusual marketing arrangement. And
right.
Good for you.
You can't do that with a novel, though. That's like...
No. Well, you know, and isn't that what a novel is about, or even a short story? You want to be private and alone. You want to be in a quiet space, even if you just have earbuds on. And you want to go into that other world.
Yeah.
It's not a public activity.
Mm-mm.
And that's okay. We're allowed, you know, but how to make it easy for other people to find the good works, the Insect Dreams, your book, my book. That's the trick, how to do
right.
that.
That is. Once we can figure that out, we'll have it made.
Yeah. Tell me if you figure it out, okay?
Believe me, I'll scream it from the mountaintops. I'll be jumping up and down on everybody's rooftop.
Okay.
Oh my goodness. Well, thank you very much, Lynn. I had a great time. I think the conversation was perfect.
Well, I enjoyed myself a lot, Jason, and thank you so much. I'm honored to be included in this codpiece. I'm saying it all wrong. Podcast. Codpiece. I don't think so.
What?
Say that fast.
Don't disappear on me just yet.
Okay.
All right. There you have it. My conversation with Lynn Sloan. I hope you enjoyed that. Be back in 2 weeks. I'm not sure what we're going to have in 2 weeks. It might be another interview. It could be a new version of the Shop Talk episodes with a new writer friend of mine. And we're trying to iron all of that out. It's getting kind of to the last minute, and I'm a bit nervous. So I don't want to say who it might be. You won't know them. I mean, maybe you've already talked to them. Maybe you do know them. Maybe it's you. See you later.